I'm Dale Jampgard, and I live in Portland, Oregon, where I work as a counselor in private practice and also do some work with Lutheran Family Service. I'm trained as a social worker and as a pastor, and have had a concern throughout my years of how do we relate our faith to the issues of everyday life. And so that's what I would like to look at with you tonight. Under the topic, the role of faith in wellness and healing. First, when we look at Jesus and his ministry, we see that a very significant part of his ministry was related to healing. Many stories of healing. And some men have said, well, that was Jesus, but he never intended for us to heal. However, we have in the scriptures, he telling the disciples to go out and heal. And then when he sent out the 70, he told them to go out and heal. And they certainly seem to have a sense that people were called to heal. And it has been a part of the church tradition, church history. And yet in our current church life, there's often a real discomfort around the whole idea of healing. And I think if we asked our average church member in our Lutheran orientation whether our faith had anything to do with wellness, health, and healing, and they might say, well, maybe, but we're not like them, meaning the faith healers. I had one pastor at a district convention. I raised the question because I read the description of ministry that was part of the documents for merger. And there wasn't any indication, any word for healing in there. And so I was raising that question at a district convention, and a pastor came up to me and said, do you want us to sound like Oral Roberts? And so we have some discomfort with the idea that that the church is really about healing. And I'd like to address that tonight and take a look at with you at some of the reasons maybe why we have moved the church out to the edge of the healing process, where we think of the major healing as being done in the medical field, and if things get serious, you call the pastor and he prays with you and maybe the prayer might help. And but it's almost seen as auxiliary, not central to the healing process. And we have very little sense of how wellness is related to faith. And so I'd like to look at some of these issues with you tonight. First, to take a look at how Jesus uses the word faith. He certainly says often, and we as Lutherans know this well, if you have faith, you are saved, you have eternal life, and it is related to our salvation with God, our restoration in our relationship to God. And so we hear that clearly as justification by faith. Faith is the way we receive that gift of the grace of God, that he affirms us, forgives us, and renews us as the person that we are, that God made us. And we are children of God. We understand that if you have faith, you are a child of God. But Jesus also uses faith in another way. And we often don't focus on that. And that is, he says, if you have faith, you can do. That faith has to do with the ability to do things. If you have faith, you can walk on water. If you have faith, you can move mountains. If you have faith, you can heal. And so I'd like to look with you tonight at the relationship of faith to the ability to do things, to be healed, to be empowered. Now, Jesus uses faith then in relation to healing in two ways. First, he says, you're welcome to bring in some more chairs if you'd like. He says, your faith has made you whole, and relates faith to wellness or wholeness. He also says then to the disciples, when they had difficulty healing, he said, O ye of little faith. So it's the faith of the individual being healed, and also the faith of the person doing the healing, that seem related to the process of healing. And there are studies being done now where the faith of the healer, even the doctor, seems somehow to be very significant. One story is kind of fun. A doctor had a patient who had an allergy that was extremely difficult for her, and a drug company had indicated that they had a new medicine, and he sent for it and gave her the medicine and was really very positive about it, hopeful about it, and gave her the medicine, and she cleared up, improved greatly. And then he gave her a second prescription, and he decided to test whether it was the medicine or her belief in the medicine that was having the effect. So the second time he gave her a placebo, and she came back and said, Doctor, that second batch of medicine just didn't do it for me. Some of the symptoms have come back. And so he said, and he wrote the drug company and said, wow, you've got an excellent medicine there, because I've tested it, and I found that the medicine was very effective because the placebo didn't have the same effect as the medicine. The drug company did some checking and wrote him a letter and said, we are sorry, sir, but there was some confusion. And when we sent you that first batch of medicine, we sent you a placebo. But he believed in it. So, okay. Let's stop that line of thinking for a moment and then take a look at another line of thinking, and that is what's happening in the medical field. Just to take it back to René Descartes, philosopher, who said that mind and body are really separate entities and that we need to study them in different ways. And you study the mind by dialogue and reflection, and you study the body by analyzing its parts and seeing how it functions. Now, that may sound like old hat to you, but up until that time, there was very little research on the body, because it was believed that to cut the body was to cut the person and destroy part of the person, and you didn't tamper with the person. So separating the mind and body began to give permission to analyze the body and to try to understand it. What developed was, in many ways, a kind of mechanical view of the body, that the body is a machine and we can analyze how it works, and we can take its parts out and put parts in and put medications in and affect the body. And we really began to feel that all we really needed to do was treat the body, and that the mind and body were really two separate entities. And it is only in the last 5 years that we have begun to really understand how much the mind can affect the immune system. It was thought that the immune system was a separate functioning entity in the body that was not affected by the mind. And so it's only relatively recently that there has been a growing emphasis on the powerful interaction between the mind and the body. And Dr. Sobel now says that the mind affects all 200 billion cells, I believe it is, in the body. These numbers escape me. So we're beginning to look at the mind-body interaction. There was another thing that happened, I think, as a result of the mechanical view of the body, is that we began to have a sense that a person is an it. And we began to sense that one person relates to another, and essentially seeing the separateness of persons. Two its, two machines. Excuse me. And I think that also affected our theology. I think we began to sense a relationship to the person God, but only seeing it in terms of relationship. Something that connect, something that relates over a separateness with God. God is person, we're person. And so we have a real comfort with the concept of reconciliation with God. Oh, that we understand. Forgiveness, that we understand. But healing is hard to understand when it's only a relationship. The alternative is to realize how we are connected to God, and that healing takes place in the connection as well as the relationship. And so I'd like to look with you at ways we might understand how we are connected to God rather than just related to. Couple of stories. There was a football game in Los Angeles, and a person was brought into the infirmary who was vomiting and retching, and a couple other people were brought in, and pretty soon they became concerned of where this vomiting, retching reaction was coming from, and a physician determined somehow that it was as a result of the soda pop in the machine, and made an announcement over the loudspeaker that look out for the soda pop, it was causing a violent vomiting reaction. As you might guess, people all over the stadium became ill, and they rushed some 200 people to the hospital, violently ill. And then in further checking, he discovered it had nothing to do with a soda pop. He announces that over the loudspeaker, and people get well. So what we believe has a tremendous effect on how our body reacts. And we're beginning to look at these different dimensions. Another story. Mr. Wright went into the hospital with cancer of the lymph node, and really was quite a ways along, secondary symptoms, and he heard of the drug crebiocin and asked if he couldn't be given that drug. And the doctor said, well, I don't know that it's going to do any good, but we'll get the drug for you. And fortunately, that hospital had been designated as an experimental hospital. So they were able to get the drug and give it to him. And the doctor gave it to him on Friday, and thought on Monday he'd come back and find him in essentially the same condition. Instead, he found him up and out of bed, moving about, feeling good, and then within a day or two, he went home and continued to improve and had a couple of months of really good progress and improvement. In terms of arresting the cancer and also improving from the secondary effects. Then he read an article, and the article said crebiocin is really questioned. It's doubted whether it has any real benefit. And he, within a few days, the symptoms began returning. He came back into the hospital, and it looked like things were going to progress rather rapidly. The doctor thought, well, it worked once, maybe it'll work again. And so he gave the man a medicine. He said, they have done some improvements on crebiocin, and I'd like to have you try it again because I think this will work. Instead, he gave him a placebo at that point. And again, in response to the medicine, the man began to recover again and improve significantly. And before long, he was able to go home and again continued improving. Until 3 months later, symptoms began to return. He came in and said, the symptoms are returning. The doctor said, what happened? He said, well, I read the article. It said the AMA says crebiocin is worthless. And within a few days, he died. So there are many stories like this. And it's a phenomena that doctors are familiar with. And we're beginning then out of that phenomena to say, what happens? What is that mind-body interaction that is so powerful? There are a number of books Bernie Siegel is a surgeon and has written a book, Love, Medicine, and Miracle. This book is available over at the bookstore. It's an excellent book talking about the role of the mind and one's determination to live and the ability to overcome cancer and other illnesses. Love, Medicine, and Miracle, written. And he really comes not out of, I don't think, a Christian orientation, but comes down strong on the importance of religious faith and talks about how he grows in his own personal faith as he grapples with religion. The Healer Within is a book that has the best compendium of research on mind-body interaction. And one of its key thoughts is that our illnesses grow out of our overreaction and our underreaction to circumstances in life. And Superimmunity is just a very recent book coming out, includes a lot of research. And one of his theses is, it's not the stress in life, it's as we try to control life out of our own self-centeredness and our own selfishness that we create much of our stress and create our own illnesses. So it comes back to how we believe about ourselves and how we approach life. That is his theme. Herbert Benson, the cardiologist at Harvard, did some research on transcendental meditation and other things and came up with the conclusion that if everyone spent 10, 20 minutes in the morning, 10, 20 minutes in the afternoon, or late, early evening, relaxing in a totally meditative, relaxed state, not flaking out on the sofa, but in a meditative state, there's a difference. And focusing, at first he said, just focus on the word one or any phrase that you want to focus on. And that book was called The Relaxation Response. Several years later, he has now come out with a book called Beyond the Relaxation Response. And what he says here is that it will have even more benefit if when you meditate or relax, you focus on your faith. Focus on the spiritual dimension. And he too then comes out not out of a religious orientation. So it's interesting that there is encouragement for faith and a faith orientation coming out of the medical field and really relating that to health and wellness and healing. There's a new field called psychoneuroimmunology, which is studying now this dynamic relationship between the mind and body. Okay, another thing we did when we saw the body as a machine and as kind of the important aspect is, what did we do with the soul? Where is the soul? Down here, 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 you know, where is the soul? Meister Eckhart, a mystic back in, I think, the 15th century, had a fascinating phrase that I really love. He said, the soul is not in the body. The body is in the soul. Notice the flip that happens. Yeah, who you are, created in the image of God, that's what it's all about. And these are merely some slow-moving particles of who you are. And we're going to get to slow-moving particles in a moment. Now, how to think about this? How are we related to God? What difference does faith make? And what are we as a person? I've got an attempt, at least, to picture a theology. And I'd like to pass it out to you here. I found a verse that was very interesting, and I shared it with a seminary professor who said he hadn't ever really been aware of that verse. And yet it's in two of our gospel lessons. Let me share it with you. In Luke 11:33, Jesus is talking. He says, "No one, after lighting a lamp, puts it in a cellar or under a bushel, but on a stand, that those who enter may see the light." Then he says, "Your eye is the lamp of your body. When your eye is sound, your whole body is full of light. But when it is not sound, your body is full of darkness. Therefore, be careful lest the light in you be darkness. If then your whole body is full of light, having no part dark, it will be wholly bright, as when a lamp with its rays give you light." If your eye is sound, is that a way of talking about faith? If we are tuned in faith, do we become light in some way? Is that why saints were depicted with auras or halos? I used to think it was an artistic trick. But maybe it's that people who are really tuned in faith have a clarity about them, a presence, an aura, however we want to say it, that they seem bright. And maybe you've seen that in some people who just are clear. Okay. Now, where does all this fit in? And let's do some playing around before we get to that. First, what is a body? Well, one of the ways of understanding the body was the reductionist method, the scientific method that said if we can just find the smallest part, we find the molecule and the atoms, then the electrons and neutrons, the whole universe of electrons and neutrons, and then we found quarks. And then about a year and a half ago, I read an article, and it said that we had now found the boson. Oh, okay. Now, a boson was described in the article as a momentary burst of energy that lasts a millionth of a millionth of a millionth of a second. And that maybe things are made up of bosons. Well, a couple of problems. One is Heisenberg's principle of indeterminacy, and that is that anything that you would try to measure a boson with will change it. So it's hard to actually know what a boson is or to actually measure it. We can observe it, but it's hard to measure it. But the other thing is that physicists in some ways are becoming mystics. And what that's about is the idea that this boson that keeps happening seems to happen with purpose. In other words, the bosons that make up my arm have somehow the purpose of being arm. And so a kind of philosophical question comes then, well, wait a minute, is what things are really made up of is purpose or mind? Or in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and all things that were made in Him. And the Word becomes flesh, and the Word becomes, and the Word becomes. So that possibly what we're realizing is that the earth and everything about it is always in the becoming process, an interaction between Word and energy or flesh. Or another way of talking about it then, and if we just start with our own capacities, is consciousness. Maybe there is a consciousness about us that we tune into and that our consciousness continues to shape the way we are. One little phenomenon, have you noticed how people who are married to each other for many years begin to look alike? Wonder how that happens. Maybe because they begin to think alike. So what we're beginning to be aware of is an interaction, a powerful interaction between consciousness and energy, which I've tried to depict here. One is that we're a happening. And it's a lot easier to imagine a thought, an electrical charge called a thought, to be able to affect a happening. Whereas when we view the body as a machine, it was hard to conceive that faith would have anything to do with the machine. And so then we had to think of some way that God, if he was going to heal, would zap you with some kind of supernatural zap. And that seemed kind of unlikely. You can pray for that, but the chances are, you know, we were having difficulty with accepting that. Now, if we understand then that really what we are made up of, that we have a lot of bodies. What I meant by slowest moving body, you have your solid body that you can see, the material body, and then you have a heat body, and you have a vapor body, you have an electrical body, a magnetic body, an olfactory body, an energy body, a body of light. How far out does that go? And how far out does your mind go? The mind is different than the brain. The brain is 3 pounds of matter up here. But how far does your mind extend? Last summer, here at Holden, a friend of mine woke up in the middle of the night, was extremely disturbed and upset, didn't know why. A couple days later, she left Holden and found out that at about that time, her sister had been killed in an automobile accident in Alaska. How far out are you interactive? Okay, now we've got a happening, and we've got a dynamic movement is what we are. This then, we can begin to tune into this verse that I read you, that God's light and God's love are about us. And that we are, in a sense, maybe like a terminal. Let's try this image. If I set a television set here, is it a television set if this is all there is?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a television set.
Is it? Okay. What does a television set do?
It receives a signal.
Oh. Is it a television set without the signal?
Well, I think it is.
Okay. Mute point, maybe, but the point is that really a television set cannot be a television set without the transmitting station in terms of its function and its purpose. It cannot function as a television set without the transmitting station. Now, we have a television set here, and around it are all the waves of color, sound, light, images, all kinds of things around it. And as it is tuned in, and if you've gotten down with those dials and played with them, you find you can get all kinds of things. You can get a lot of static, and you can get snow, and you can get different patterns and distortions and things going all over the place. And only as it begins to really tune in do the colors come clear and the figures get clear and the sound blossom. And only then does the television set come to life. I'm wondering if we aren't like television sets, created in the image of God, that we're a terminal for the manifestation of God, and that as we tune in through faith, that we grow in the realization of God's love and light being in us and working through us and empowering us for life. That God's love and light is here, all about us. And if you have faith, you can know that you're a child of God and you can tune in. That raises the question then, why do we have difficulty tuning in? And let's take a look. Is that what sin is all about? That instead of living in that light, we live in darkness. And even when we begin to get tuned into the light, we have pockets of darkness. And even one day when we seem to discover a lot of light, the next day we slip into darkness. What's that about? Well, I believe that it's about the opposite of faith, and that is fear. Jesus says, if you build your house on the sand, the winds will come and will shake you. What is fear? The devil comes to Jesus in the wilderness, and his purpose is to create anxiety and fear. And how does he do it? He starts with a two-letter word. Know what it is? If. If you are the Son of God, If you are somebody, prove it. Do something. And so the devil tries three ways. He says, if you are the Son of God, turn these stones into bread. Prove, know that you're the Son of God by doing something. And Jesus says, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. I live by the grace of God. Period. Nothing I need to do. The devil isn't easily thwarted, so he comes back and he says, hey, Jesus, if you really are the Son of God, then jump off the pinnacle and get God to send his angels and take care of you. We know that as, if you really want to know you're somebody, get people to like you, praise you, take care of you, respond to you, and then you will know you're somebody because of all of what people will do for you. Recognize that one? And then when they don't do it, what do we say? Oh, I'm nobody. I'm worthless. Nobody loves me. Nobody cares. I'm nothing. Yeah. And the third one is, Jesus, if you really want to be somebody, just bow down to me and I'll give you all. All the lands, all the possessions, all the power in the world. And so we try to prove who we are by the having the things that we have, hanging on to them, grasping them, seeking the positions of power from which we can know and prove that we're somebody. Now, it is that attempt to prove in some way that we're somebody that is our enslavement to sin. It grows out of a fear of being nobody and an attempt to create a somebody, and we all do it, and we all live in it, and it's hard for even us to recognize it. But it is the way we destroy ourselves. Why? Because when I'm trying to prove something, then I have to hold myself in, down, back, up, strive, strain, push, make sure things happen. So I put all kinds of strain and stress on myself. I overreact and underreact, and I begin to wear out my system, and I create my illnesses. Also then, we can't relate to one another because we need to use each other to make ourselves important. And finally, we can't relate to the things of the earth because we misuse them, overuse them, and destroy them in the process. Now, let me share with you a little of how subtle that is. What I came to realize for myself. I grew up in a family where we were members of the Lutheran Church, very active in the church. My mother was Sunday school superintendent for many years. Really a very loving family. I was very fortunate. I was anxious about who I was. I was a skinny kid and worried. I wasn't very tough and anxious about myself. And so out of that fear, I tuned in to my parents and said, what do you have to do to be somebody? I didn't actually say that, but, you know, that was the kind of question. Well, in our family, my mother especially had a be responsible orientation, where every Sunday when we would come home, or whenever we'd come home from church, we'd have a meeting and talk about how things went and how the things could be done better and what we had to do about it. So I felt like we were responsible for everything. I had two younger brothers, always take care of them, and so I became very responsible. taking care of everybody and always trying to figure out how to make things better, because that was the way I could prove that I was somebody. Well, now I went on, became a social worker, and then I went on and became a pastor. And how virtuous can you get? And finally it hit me that even when I was in the pulpit preaching the sermon or even administering the sacrament and being super responsible for everybody, it was the essence of my sin. That's what sin is about, is being enslaved to trying to prove something, no matter what you're doing. And it destroys what you do, ultimately. Because I was straining my own body, I was feeling a lot of neck tension, I had some headaches, and I was beginning to feel like I wasn't doing enough and always trying to do more, and I could make myself sick that way. And when I would meet a person, I couldn't love them. Why? Because I was trying to figure out what their problem was so I could be responsible for them. Now, it looks like caring, but ultimately it's destructive because it's manipulation. It's not really affirming. And then I would try to gather around me the evidences that I was being responsible for my family and providing the things and so forth. Now, that's the subtlety of it. Jesus said that he came to heal the sick. Who's sick? All of us. The seeds of any illness that you have are very likely in you now, in the way you are living your life, in the way you are thinking and believing. Because to a great extent, for the most part, many illnesses we create ourselves. And if not, you know, only within ourselves, it's also how we were treated as children, and it may be genetically caused in some ways because some things get passed on from one generation to another. Now, when I'm afraid and trying to prove something, how tuned in am I to the light? I'm not, and I live in darkness because I'm doing this rather than this. And so faith then is a letting go of the fear and opening up and knowing that God promises to live in me and through me and feed me and enable me and empower me as I walk in that relationship, as I tune in to him and his will. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done. Now, how do we move from fear to faith? Just like that? No. We're enslaved to that fear. We're bound up, tied up in it, and we cannot get free by our own reason or strength, says Luther. How do we get free? A little boy was born. By 3 months old, his parents were told, your child has an IQ of 30, and you might as well prepare to take care of him for the rest of your life. Instead of accepting that, they got down with their child and did what their child did, entered into his world, tried to understand and be with him. If he cried, they would kind of cry. If he rocked, they would rock. If he crawled, they'd crawl. Whatever he did, they would enter in and try to be with him at the point where he was at. And as they did this over a year's period, 5 hours a day, why, gradually the child began to respond and show more normal responses. The story that I read was written when he was in fourth grade and he was at the top of his class. What does it mean to enter into a person's reality and be with them where they are afraid and stuck in their fear? That's what incarnation is all about. God sent Jesus to be with us. And notice the three things under the cross. He came to be with us and walk with us into suffering. In other words, the fear of our own lack of power. He entered into a powerlessness himself in order that we might know that he can be with us in the depths of our fear of lacking power. Secondly, he walked with us into our fear of rejection, the second temptation, remember? And he was rejected and spit upon and beat and rejected even by his friends. He welcomes us to walk with him into that fear of rejection. And finally, he walks with us into the fear of death, which is the loss of everything that we have. All position, all power, all things are gone in death. And he goes through death with us in order that we might discover the victory. He says, because I live, you too shall live. You do not need to be afraid anymore. There is nothing you need to prove about who you are. Receive who you are as a unique gift from God. God has made you unique and has placed you in this place in the course of human history to be you, and invite you to let go and receive who you are. And let go then and tune in to the love and the light of God that is about. And it is that tuning that we do through Christ, who says it in different ways. The kingdom of God is at hand. My spirit I send unto you. If your eye is sound, you shall become full of light and you will become bright as a lamp. Faith is a daily process of dying, dying to that self we've tried to create and tried to prove, losing that life in order that we might come to life as the person that we are in the image of God. It's a daily time of letting go and knowing and receiving God into our life, and then discovering the power of living life. Let's look at it in terms of these three words. Peace. Again, peace that passes all understanding. Letting go of the fear and the anxiety. There is nothing finally that we need to be anxious about, because finally the kingdom of God is at hand. Hope. That is knowing that in all situations there is hope because the kingdom of God is at hand. It's another reality that is present. It's another way of seeing reality. And this then becomes a whole new way of life. The Sermon on the Mount does not make any sense if we just see reality that is obvious to us. And I think if you ask many people, does this make sense? If someone forces you to go 1 mile, go two. If someone hits you on one cheek, turn the other. If someone gives you or takes your coat, give them your cloak as well. What's the response of our people today? Well, maybe Jesus in your day, that might have worked, but not today. I mean, this is dog eat dog. This is competition. This is, you know, we've got to live a different way. No! Jesus says this is a new way to live life, and the only way we can live that life is to see the kingdom of God that is at hand, because it changes the way we see everything, the way we see ourselves, the way we see other people, the way we see the course of events. And so it is a perspective that changes. And then love is the action. And what is love? Itzhof Manoff, a physicist, said, maybe love is like gravitation. It's that which holds things together. Maybe it's that force that gives everything purpose in the whole universe. And so to love is to move with that purpose and to hold things together. Now, you are designed as a love being, a love machine. You're designed for love. If you don't love, you're not going to live. To love is to live. To love is to come to life in the fullest sense. To love is to live with that real realization that you can't love too much. You can't give more than you'll get. Because that's how you're designed. If you want to be the most that you are, love then is an opportunity, not an obligation. It's an opportunity for you to be you. And you love then in order, not in order to be somebody, but because you are a child of God by His grace. That then is my sense of what wellness is about. Wellness is a daily process of dying to come to life, of tuning into God's presence, and discovering the excitement of being a manifestation of the image of God where you are in this life, as Jesus showed us how and called us to. And healing then happens when we realize also that we need to be forgiven. It happens in the process of forgiveness. It happens in the process of tuning into God's presence. This book here says, all you need to do is get quiet. Let go of all your agendas. Just be quiet and focus on God. And it has a tremendous healing effect. If we get out of our anxious, striving way, we've got a very powerful healing system within us that God can empower. So this is my sense of the relationship then of faith to healing and health. Let me stop at that point and invite you for some of your reactions. What do you see in here?
Have you ever done a workshop for type A people?
Well, I've worked with type A people in counseling and other things, yes. Both type A and type B are each trying to prove things in different ways, and type A happens to be more prone to heart attacks. Partly because the reaction, there's something that happens in us that grabs inside when we keep trying to make things happen and control them, and which is a characteristic of the type A. And it may be that every time we go like that, we grab cholesterol in our veins and begin to clog up things.
It was interesting to me what you said about this experience with this cancer patient, because years ago when I was in training, that I was a doctor that just worked with the cancer patients, and he had a man that had cancer, and he never told him because he didn't want to tell him or anything, you know, and he had it. He was getting along fine. I mean, he was taking all his treatments and doing everything, and then one day the doctor went on a vacation. And when he was there, another doctor took over. And then he said to this man, he says, "So you got cancer." He died within a week. And that was years and years ago.
Norman Cousins has surveyed 300 cancer patients and found that their illness usually became worse at the time of diagnosis. And so part of it, I think, is just a belief or a fear that cancer means only one thing to us.
Is one of the things that you would recommend then to say, if I understand you correctly, it's you would recommend that a person should spend, spend some time during the day, going to say meditating, but just being quiet and listening to himself, he would at least once a day.
Yes, I think it would make a significant difference. And it's one thing to do devotions, but often what we do is read a scriptures and try to figure it out and be concerned about what we have to say. So, and that's one way of knowing, and that's a valid way. But the whole receptive way of just letting things in is another way of knowing. Be still and know that I am God. Just let go. Stop trying to figure it all out. Just be with me.
I was thinking about the young people that are always plugged in, and some of the older ones too. And I've always thought that that was kind of their opium, their way to hide and escape and so on. And maybe they're hiding and escaping hearing God. I don't know. And I won't play county music in on your meditation. That's a good idea. I'm studying music therapy right now.
That's a very good idea.
It depends on the music, and it depends on your preference. All music distracts me to itself. So, and it depends on the person.
Sure. Yeah, it can be useful. The other concern I have is that, in addition to a daily process, I think we need in our church a small group place where we deal with our issues of faith through hearing God's word, through prayer together, and through dialogue with each other, thinking and working together. And because we cannot do this alone, and Sunday morning worship is not enough because it's not dialogical. You don't have a chance to say, wonder what this means in the light of my life here today. And I'm hoping that our Lutheran church will move much more towards a small group process where we can share this transformation process, this wellness and healing process with one another. And so that what happens on Sunday morning, it becomes a celebration of what's gone on all week rather than the yet for the week. We as Lutherans have some good Bible study programs, and sometimes we tend to get focused again on figuring out the text and not really sharing where we're at as persons, and that might be the area that I think we can grow in.
I wish you'd say a word about how we incorporate this way of living or approach with friends, with loved ones, for whom their physical death does take place. I'm not trying to ask the question about being guilty because you die, but as loved ones reach their death, you know, how can we incorporate some of this learning into that experience?
Okay. We all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and because of the fall, death entered in. In other words, I believe that ultimately death is a result of sin in our lives. And so it's not that one person needs to feel more guilty than that, but it's part of our sinfulness and sinful relationships and ways in life. And to be with people and just help them know that the grace of God is also available to them and that there is forgiveness for wherever we've been. I think it's interesting, an interesting bind, and that is, people have said, well, if you say that a person's illness is somehow the result of the way they've lived their life, or that healing is related to faith and they aren't healed, then will they feel bad and will they feel guilty? And well, what about that? Is the alternative to say that illness has nothing to do with the way we've lived our life and nothing to do with sin? It's just something that accidentally happened to us?
What happens to the babies that are born with cerebral palsy and all those people that are born with diseases that they have no control over?
Okay, sure. There are genetic factors. There are many factors involved in illness, and I have no problem with that. Mm-hmm. But I'm concerned because I'm wondering if we as Lutherans have become uncomfortable with really being identified as sinners. That we'd hate to emphasize that because someone might feel guilty. But also we are saints by the grace of God, and we can identify that and live with that. And that's an important part too. But this is a difficult issue, and I appreciate you raising it. No simple answer.
I too share that struggle, Cheryl, and I know there's I'm working on hospice training, and there you have a whole set of circumstances that are not headed toward curing, but a different kind of wholeness. So Henry Nouwen's comment on "we are called not to cure but to care" has been a freeing experience for many of the trainees and trainers, that we are so fix or mend or get better oriented that we forget that caring is much larger, certainly, than that. And it's allowed us then to be bold and to move along the process of a larger picture of wellness and to share feelings and to share remembrances and to celebrate the old times.
Yes, and the idea of caring, however, may not change the situation of the body itself, but we can always be in the process of caring, growing in our faith relationship with God and with someone that is dying, whose body has reached the point of death, to continue to work with the healing process of the whole person.
And there was one other connection I was thinking of earlier, talking about the light. I stumbled across a comment that there's a Quaker tradition about the fact when you are praying intercessory for someone else, that they speak of that as holding them in the light. And I got to thinking that that also is a freeing experience, because you don't then want to pray that such and such specific thing happens to get, you know, to help their situation, but you hold them in the light.
Hold them in the light.
And
yes.
That's a whole new kind of release of intercessory.
And expands the sense of healing.
Much more significant.
Yeah. Over here. Yes.
I'd be kind of interested in knowing how many people have a healing service in their church. We use a Lutheran healing service one Sunday evening month in our congregation.
Okay, let's ask. How many use it? How many have a healing service in your church? Okay. Now, there is a liturgical form for the healing service, and I think that's very helpful and a good thing. It often takes, however, helping people begin to understand it and how to use it.
Yeah, we have very few people that take advantage of it, but we see marvelous things happening to people because of it. And I just wonder, you know, how many Lutherans are really...
visited a Lutheran church in Florida that was Hispanic and white, and there the pastor always had a vial of oil, and anyone when receiving communion that wanted to be anointed for healing would just indicate that, then he would take the oil and anoint for healing and pray with them for their healing, just as they would receive communion.
My pastor also carries oil.
Okay, so
we
there...
also have a layperson.
We do have kind of the basic elements of a healing orientation, and it's a matter, I think, to grow. And yet I don't want to limit it to a liturgical service. There's other aspects of healing I think we need to open up to and to understand it. Yes?
This is a different tack. It goes back to your analogy of the television set. And I don't know how far you would want to take that, but if I understood you correctly, You see us as television sets, and you see God as the transmission station, and that's where the light comes from. Do you also see that there are other transmitters out there, that the devil is also transmitting, and that that's problematic for many people? I don't know, it just, the thought occurred to me when you used that analogy.
Okay, I hadn't pushed it that far. Yeah. But something creates the static and the darkness.
I was going to say jamming.
Jamming? All right. Yes, I think we could build some other images into that model that could have that effect. Okay. Well, thank you. And I think I did mention this book is in the library if you'd like to have that. The others are not. In the bookstore. The others are not here. Tomorrow night I'm going to deal with the topic, ways of knowing. How do we approach knowing, and what difference can that make for us?